ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley. Welcome to the Saltz Mongolusi Bendesky Hour. We've got a fantastic show. We're going to be talking medical malpractice today. We have Steve Wigweiser, Mary Jadaro, and Jason Weitz of Saltz Mongolusi and Bendesky. First, Steve, how are you, sir?
I'm doing terrific today, Joe. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's great to be here. Usually we have, I'm used to being in what I call the unfair advantage. They say the White House was created to create an unfair advantage to foreign heads of state. Well, when you come up here and you're in the offices of Saltz Mongolusi and you look out from the 52nd floor, man, oh man, you know, I can only imagine what it's like being on the other side, coming up and going, fellas, you want to mail this in or what? Ironically, I was an iron worker, a union iron worker. So we built this, and I remember the day we crossed, went past Billy Penn's hat, and this is the first building ever, Liberty One. So I'm pretty much at home here. Jason, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. And, of course, Mary, how are
yes,
you?
Yes, I'm great.
Awesome. So, Steve, if you would, you're the chair of the medical malpractice department. If you would introduce yourself,
absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about what you do.
Well, first of all, I am a lifelong Philadelphian, born and raised in the city, in the Alney section.
Yep.
I went to Central High School, Penn State University, and then BU School of Law.
Awesome.
And all that happened a long, long time ago. I've been practicing since 1979, and there's probably not a type of personal injury case that I have not handled over the years. But in recent decades, I have concentrated my practice in the area that we commonly refer to as medical malpractice, that some refer to as professional negligence. I'm thrilled to be running the MedMal department. I have terrific attorneys and terrific staff. You're going to meet two of the attorneys today with Jason and Mary, and we represent Philadelphians who have had encounters with the healthcare industry in which the outcomes have been below standards and unacceptable. We are piecing together a lot of lives that have been torn apart by medical negligence, and we do it full time. As I often say, 24/7, we are open for business, and I'm thrilled to be in the position that I'm in.
Fantastic. Certainly, you're nationally acclaimed. You've been doing this a long time, and Saltz Mongolusi is obviously represents clients at the highest level. Let me bring into the program Mary Jadaro. How are you, Mary?
Hi. Great to meet you today.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do here at Saltz Mongolusi.
Okay. So I've been an attorney for 30 years, and like Steve, I'm also a graduate of Penn State University.
Nittany Lions.
There you go. We are Penn State,
yes.
Right?
And originally, I had a background in nutrition science, and then later I went on to law school at Villanova University, and I've been practicing for 30 years, and majority of the time in medical malpractice cases, and since I had some experience in working at hospital facilities, it provides a background for me in the medical field, which is helpful in the cases that I handle.
Well, it's your background. It goes hand in hand, and certainly, it's medical malpractice is a very interesting area. By the way, everybody, and I know everybody self-diagnoses, so I can only imagine how many thousands of people have called and said, I have a med mal case. I had a buddy of mine who just said it to me a couple weeks ago, I have a medical malpractice case, and I'm an iron worker, and I'm going, I'm not a lawyer, brother, but I don't think you do.
Probably not.
You're doing great.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Jason, if you will.
I like to say that we have about 100 years of experience on the medical malpractice team of trial experience. I account for about a decade of that.
Okay.
So I am a little bit less in terms of experience than Steve and Mary, but I'm very fortunate to work with them. I went to GW undergrad, and I went to Rutgers for law school.
Yeah, Joe, I don't want him to undersell himself.
Yeah.
All right. He is a very, very bright and capable attorney. He's clerked for multiple judges. I put Jason and Mary up against any legal team in the city, the state, or even the country. And it's because of them that we're able to do the tremendous work that we do for our clients.
And I'll tell you, obviously, Saltz Mongolusi, Bendesky, the reputation of the firm is second to none, nationally acclaimed. I've told this story on almost every show we've been on, but as an iron worker, they're catastrophic. You know, we get, there's barely any non-catastrophic injuries. The first case, I think it was Andrew Duffy and Bob. We did it. We were doing a show, and we were talking about it. My father, who was the business manager of our union, used to send all of our cases here, even at work comp. He would just send it here, and you got, because he knew obviously that, you know, that these are catastrophically injured cases. When we started off, I worked on the Frankfurt L 25 years ago, and my boss, his name was Mike Whitland, and Mike Whitland was the first big case that Mongoose ever had. It was the Tropicana collapse, and he got killed in that. The firm did such an incredible job, and that was in Atlantic City. But I didn't know that when we were doing the show. And I think right. Andrew told me, and Bob, of course, jumped on it, and it was shocking. But obviously, you know, the firm is nationally acclaimed and recognized for the work that you do. Let's talk a little bit about expectations when it comes to the clients. What can they expect when they retain a member of this team?
Well, I'm gonna kick this off.
Sure.
Because I think the single most important thing is communication. And it is the most frequently voiced complaint that I hear from clients who are dissatisfied with lawyers. I used to sit as a hearing examiner for the disciplinary board, which would, of course, look at lawyers who have committed actions that they regret.
Sure.
And that have harmed their clients. And it always starts off the same way. You know, he didn't return my phone calls. You know, he would have other people call in his or her place. And I think the Saltz Mongolusi difference starts with a high level of communication. Some people may be critical of me for this, but my clients not only have our main number, they have my cell phone number.
Sure.
All right, I'm responsive to emails. I'm responsive to texts. I'm responsive to any means of communication. And the reason is because we understand the importance. We understand how anxious clients are going through the legal process. And we want to be 100% transparent. Right. Nobody's blowing sunshine. Nobody's blowing smoke here. If there's something I'm excited about in your case, you're going to know about it. If there's something I'm concerned about in your case, you're going to know about it. And because we're transparent, we don't fear communication. Right. And the bonus for us, and I know I'm getting a little ahead of us, but the bonus is when it comes time to make the really important decisions in the case. We're going to settle the case. We're not going to settle the case. We're at trial. They offered X amount. We're going to take that. You know, what are the risks? I'm not reinventing the wheel with my clients. They already know the strengths and weaknesses of their case. You know, they know where it could come in dollar-wise. So, you know, this is an old story, and the way that we foster that knowledge and that relationship, it's all communication.
And what I find interesting, and I'll transition to Mary on this, the length of time that a medical malpractice case can take is a long time. You know, just no matter how obvious it seems, these cases can take a while.
Right.
You know, you're talking about with Steve and the communication, setting that expectation up from day one with either the family or the individual has to be a big deal, because you're in a sense setting them up for success. Otherwise, if you're not setting those expectations, you're probably getting a call in 2 weeks going, are we close? Talk about that right. conversation after you accept the case and, you know, taking them through the steps in order to set them up for success throughout the process, you know, at, you know, right at the beginning.
Okay. So, well, first I'd want to say that if someone does think that they have a medical malpractice case, it's really important to seek out an attorney as soon as possible. Because not only does the case take a while after it's placed into suit, you know, I think people have to understand it takes a while to investigate a medical malpractice case. They tend to be very complex. It takes time to get all the gather all the information, the medical records, speak with, you know, we speak with experts. So even before the case is put into suit, it involves a lot of investigation time. And that's so very important because you want to be, you really want to be prepared the moment that you file that lawsuit. You want to have all your information. And from that point, then, you know, depending upon where the lawsuit is filed, you know, different counties. So you need to walk your client through what to expect. And we have to do that from the get-go. And we, you know, they know in advance that they're going to be, you know, the communication is also going to have to be, it's a two-way street. So, you know, the client needs to also always be in a communicating with the attorney or answering the calls. And, you know, there's a lot of steps that we help them through until the lawsuit comes to a conclusion. So it involves, you know, depositions and, you know, obtaining experts and sometimes expert depositions. You know, and depending on where you are located, it could take anywhere from a year or 2 years to get to a trial, to get to the courthouse.
And having said that, now I'll transition to Steve. That conversation when you're sitting with that family, and it may seem, as we have an injured workers program with the union community in Philadelphia, and one particular guy swore he had a medical malpractice suit. And he had a work comp suit. He had an attorney on that work comp suit, and they were paying him. You know, however, he could not get an attorney to take that case. He swore that this big doctor, you know, made a mistake and all that, and everybody was afraid of the doctor. It wasn't until somebody explained, an individual explained to him that you may have a case, but it's not a case that you're going to wait around 2 years and it's not a valuable case. By the way, it changed the guy's life. Just being honest with him. You know, the fact that he, you know, literally, now he had the work comp case and that was fine, but medical malpractice is not, and I mean, as a lay person, and by the way, I sit here and, you know, I have all these educated people around me, but I'm your client. Okay, and so it's, you know, I'm sitting here and a listener, they want to be educated, but a lot of times there is a work comp. I mean, there is a medical malpractice case, and you mentioned something, Mary, about the things you have to do in the process. I want to think about this for one particular second. I'm going to go to Jason. Vetting a case, okay. Mm-hmm. When you vet a med mal case, and I've heard a lot of attorneys say this, I've had attorneys come into a broadcast and sit there and go through, and I mean in the hundreds have said on their website it says med mal, and I'll say, well, what do you want to talk about? And they'll go, well, I'll talk about anything, but I don't want to talk about med mal because they just refer it out, right? However, the vetting process of a medical malpractice case can be extremely extensive, and it's unbelievably important. Talk about it.
I think there's a reason that people don't love talking about it, and that's for the same reason that we experience whenever we tell people what we do. It's not quite like saying that you are working in organized crime, but people that hear that you're working in medical malpractice have an understandably visceral reaction sometimes, and that's because we rely on our doctors. I rely on physicians. Everyone around us relies on their physicians to provide care, because if you need help and you are hurt, you have to be able to go to a hospital and get it. So we're not here for the 99.99% of medical care that's provided. So it's difficult to talk about because, A, doctors make it very known that they don't like to be sued. And B, there is a feeling as society that we really need to trust in the people that we're going after. So we have to explain to everyone up front that in order for us to pursue a case, it can't just be that you were injured. It has to be that the standard of care was breached to a degree that we can explain it to 12 random people who are going to ultimately judge their fate. And for that reason, we have to be extensive in the way that we investigate cases. We have to be extremely selective in the cases that we choose to bring. And we can't right every wrong because there's just no way to do it and to appropriately serve the needs of our clients.
You know, what Steve, when you put this, when we were communicating by email, you put together, we put together the segment, and one of your questions I thought was kind of poignant, and I'm looking for it in a sense. You know, the reasons for medical malpractice. Now, I'm a regular guy, but and justice may be one of the answers, but also change happens in the courtroom.
Absolutely. We have been involved in a number of cases that have resulted in changes to hospital policies and procedures, and certainly in individual doctors' offices. Unfortunately, the way the medical industry is structured, there are very few checks and balances on physicians and other healthcare employees unless it's the most catastrophic of losses and multiple people are involved. You know, there are committees, there are hospital committees that are set up to look at bad results. Unfortunately, I think many times they are there to circle the wagons and come up with the CYA position that will ultimately protect the healthcare system. Let's get our heads together because they know it's not typically discoverable. It's not; these are not conversations that we can find out about under the legislative schemes and the decisional law in most states. And they circle the wagons. They come up with their group explanation for the bad event, and then they're a little more united and a little stronger in their defense, right? What we do when we bring cases and when we try cases and when we get jury verdicts, we focus attention on deficiencies in hospitals or deficiencies in physicians' offices. And it's true in industry at large. It's true with automobile manufacturers and other manufacturers. Until you get a financial verdict, right? Change doesn't occur. It's the reason that cars are designed appropriately. It's the reason that we have seat belts. It's the reason that we don't have asbestos. It's the reason that fall protection is mandatory. And I could go on and on and on for an hour. I wish it wasn't the case. I wish people did the right thing. If they did the right thing, I'll find something else to do. When I'm not money's worried about it.
But when money's involved, and that includes you own a business. Well, here's an example. You're in your house. You hear, you know it's a truck outside because it's going beep, 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 beep. Now, you know that truck is backing up. And that truck is backing up and that sound is there because a lawyer made that happen because somebody got badly injured because of it. You sit there. I was in the hospital and I would not have had, you know, once you get personal experience, you can relate to almost anything. But if you haven't, I remember being in the hospital about two, three years ago. My knee, I had somehow an infection on, and I'll never forget it. I was sitting there, and everybody kept coming in and asking me the same questions. The same questions. After the fourth or fifth person, I started to think, these are a bunch of different vendors coming in here individually. And I thought to myself, are they communicating? Does the left hand know what the right hand is doing? Now, here I am. You're nodding, Jason?
I am. I mean, I think that is something that we deal with frequently. we have situations where when we're looking at cases, Mary, Steve, and I, we oftentimes see that providers, healthcare providers, just aren't communicating properly. There's not enough shared information. And in 2022, when everything's available to you on your phone, there's really no excuse for a pulmonologist not knowing that a cardiologist thinks one way or the other about a procedure. There's no reason for when an emergency physician transfers care to a different specialty that his exact thoughts aren't completely transcribed and available to the physician that he's handing the care off to. But unfortunately, it does happen. It's not something that happens every day at every institution to every patient, but it is something that happens, and the breakdown in communication is oftentimes where we get involved.
Well, ironically speaking, let's kind of finish the vetting, part of it.
Right, and I also, the second half, you asked why we bring these cases.
Yeah.
Well, change is an important part of it, but our main focus is trying to put families back in the position they were in to the best of our ability before the malpractice occurred. So, for example, if a breadwinner can no longer work, or if somebody is going to require extensive medical care for the rest of his or her life, or a baby may require that kind of care in the event of an obstetrical malpractice event, we assume responsibility for replacing that breadwinner, that earner, with a verdict, right? And very few lawyers will admit it, but it is an awesome responsibility. And it's the reason why we work tirelessly to make sure that we're successful, because literally a family's future hangs in the balance in many of our cases. And that's why we wake up at 3 o'clock with ideas about cases. That's why we work so hard, because we care. And of course, the other component of compensation addresses people who are racked with pain and suffering on a minute by minute, hourly, daily, weekly, monthly basis. If you haven't been through that, if you don't understand that kind of pain, all you have to do is listen to the testimony of some of our clients. Our system of justice requires that wrongdoers compensate individuals who suffer in that fashion. And our job is to make sure that that compensation occurs. So it's the compensation component. It's the change component. And both of those items are part of what we call globally justice.
Now, justice. That's the number one, obviously, and the change that happens in the courtroom and all. The contingency fee agreement, okay? Okay, at that point, I had an attorney one time say to me, he was running for office, and he says to me, I'm not sure if I'm proud of what I do. I looked at him and I said, you're a personal injury attorney, right? He said, yeah. I said, you understand the contingency fee, right? And he was like, yeah, of course. I said, well, You level the playing field for every person that's ever had a negligent situation to be able to afford attorneys like the ones in this room right now to go out there and be represented by the best of the best. That's why when I jump into the vetting conversation, I say to myself, when you're talking about accepting a case, right, Jason? When I talk about vetting, sometimes it costs you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars before you turn a case down. I'm saying, talk about that. When somebody walks in and they are in a situation that Steve's talking about, and when I say vetting a case, talk about that process, or Mary, what you invest in a case before you even accept it.
Right. So I think what the great thing is about what we do is that the clients that we represent or the clients that we investigate cases for them, we are never going to ask them to pay us any money. So as you can imagine, with medical malpractice cases, everyone or a lot of people, even those who might not have a meritorious case, they're calling us. And even if we do not ultimately take the case, I think what our clients really appreciate is that we do a thorough investigation at and that costs them nothing. And at some point, even if we cannot take the case, we're able to give them some kind of an explanation as to why what happened, you know, it does not rise to the level of negligence. And I think they walk away feeling that, you know, they have some type of an explanation
exactly.
for what happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's what is so nice that we can do that for people who are suffering and, who've had one of their loved ones pass away.
Sure.
And so we can give them some kind of an explanation and they can feel like they did what they had to do, you know, even if it didn't end up in a case.
And that makes sense, Jason.
Yeah, I think that you asked why it is that we invest money beforehand and the cost of going into it. And I think that something that's important to remember is that if you're coming to us with a medical malpractice investigation, then you're a victim. And you feel as though someone has done something to you or a loved one that has hurt you and caused you a very serious injury. But in order to sue a doctor or a hospital, we need a physician to sign off ahead of time.
Sure.
Which changes the calculus as opposed to most other types of personal injury litigation where you sort of fire away and figure it out as you go. That's not at all what happens in medical malpractice. We need to know that we are legally supported and medically supported before we sue anyone. So that requires us to spend, honestly, an exorbitant amount of money on each and every investigation where we have to consult with experts who are willing to criticize professionals in their own field. And we can't move forward without that. And for that reason, there is a cost that comes with it. But we have to do that in order to represent our clients. There's no other way around it.
Understanding the medicine as attorneys. Okay, Mary, everybody sort of pointed to you when we were talking about, you're talking about your previous, your career, your education level and all that. How important is that? And also seeing the forest through the trees. So in other words, what somebody who, you know, may look at something and say, I don't see it. Being creative and understanding the medicine, how important is that?
It's extremely important. And you have, because with what we do, we have to look at the case and we have to come up with the theories and then we have to discuss them with our expert. And it's basically the expert who is educating us. And every step of the way, we rely on these experts because, I have somewhat of a science background, but in no way
you've been doing it for a long time.
Yes.
So you have not, your experience itself probably tells you when you have to get an expert and when it's the right thing to do.
And you also have to decide which experts have to look at this case. And, you kind of have to come to your own conclusions, but you rely on your experts to educate you on the medicine.
Right. Keep in mind that we are looking for situations where the outcome is not only extremely bad, but it's not due to the underlying disease that the individual went to the doctor with or went to the hospital with. It's got to be an outcome that was caused by the negligence of the physician.
Yeah, what are the factors that comprise a medical malpractice case?
All right. Well, just start from the very beginning. As I'm fond of saying, to start with, somebody has to do something wrong. Right. I mean, that is the fundamental basis of every legal case. I don't care if it's an antitrust case, all the way down to a slip and fall. It doesn't matter. And I don't mean to cast aspersions about premises cases because they're very, very significant cases.
Sure.
Homeowners, business owners certainly have obligations to the public and to their business invitees. But it is absolutely critical that in the first instance we determine whether a physician or a hospital was negligent. Now, you know, in our everyday life, we understand that term. It's carelessness. It's acting unreasonably. If somebody runs a stop sign or a homeowner doesn't clear an icy walk or, a merchant doesn't take precautions to protect their patrons, we get that. In the medical world, unlike other cases, doctors decide what is up to standard and what is not.
The standard of care. Like
that's the standard of care that Jason and Mary referred to.
Yep.
So we have to make a determination as to whether the harm complained about, whether the death, whether the disfigurement or dismemberment, whether the advancement of the disease was due to the underlying disease that the individual had or to a misdiagnosis or a delayed diagnosis or a surgical error or a medical pharmaceutical mistake or some other action or inaction by a physician that falls below standards. And now I've been doing this for more than 40 years. So chances are when you call me at this point, I have heard your case or a similar case before. We collectively have investigated just about every imaginable fact pattern. So we have learned, even though I don't have a medical degree, we have learned what is likely to be a case and what is not. The second component, in addition to negligence, is what we call causation. So as I said before, what damages were caused by the physician's conduct, right? So for example, if you have a late stage cancer that is likely to result in early demise, you're not going to make it very long, and you go to a physician and the physician then makes a mistake and delays a recognition of that cancer for a month. I know because I've looked at 50 to 100 cases involving that particular cancer that 1 month did not make a difference to your outcome.
Right, right.
Right? So that's an example of where the doctor may have been negligent.
Right.
Right? But it didn't cause a premature death. And, you know, the example I like to give is if you go into a hospital and they reuse a hypodermic needle, clear negligence. But if you don't get an infection, you have no case.
Exactly.
So these are some of the considerations. Then we have to look at, you know, the extent of the damages. Knowing that in many venues, jurors tend, and I think Jason alluded to this earlier, jurors tend to identify with physicians. Everybody needs a doctor. Right. And they know that. And let's face it, going back 20 years, the medical societies and the hospital industry have played that card with their own propaganda.
Of course.
All right. So if you remember back into the early 2000s, the doctors are leaving. The lawyers are driving them out. The insurance rates were too high. All right. Well, you know, none of that was true except that the insurance rates were too high. And that was blatant profiteering by the insurance industry.
Sure.
So that we've proven that you know, that ship has sailed. You know, at the end of the day, there has to be the kind of case that we can win in front of a jury that starts out as favoring the doctors and favoring the hospitals. And that's what we do.
Talk about the resources that Saltz Mangaluzzi has. And the ability, so David and Goliath.
We're blessed.
What's that?
We're blessed.
Exactly. But you're also blessed.
I don't want to beat around the bush about this. We work at a phenomenal firm with unbelievable resources and unbelievable talent, including the two attorneys that are surrounded me right now. And I have never heard no. If the question is, can I get an expert? Can I conduct this investigation? Can I travel? Can I get these medical records? It's never no. It's how fast do you need the money?
Well, it's interesting that you say that.
It's never like that for
because,
us.
Because, and I've said it to Bob and Andrew and Bob Zimmerman and everybody on the broadcast that we've done. One of the beauties of this firm is that, and I've heard other attorneys say it right in the same broadcast when we were, is that David and Goliath, it's not David and Goliath here. You have the resources to win, to investigate, to hire the experts that need that need to be a part of it. We talked about the vetting part of it, but let's also talk about the culture at the firm, in this room, the resources that you have, and the benefits of being able to, now that the pandemic is not, you know, we're coming out of it, yell in the other room, yo, Jason, can you come on in here? Steve, can you come in? Mary, can you take a look at this? And now everybody's in the same room again. Not that you couldn't call each other, but the point is, what type of benefit is that to know that you have the resources to win? And what advantage of that is when you're talking to the insurance company, number one, and you're representing a client? I mean, it's got to be, you know, next level.
They know that at the end of the day, we don't just talk the talk. We can walk the walk, right? We're in the courtrooms. We're trying cases. We're getting verdicts. We don't back down. This is one of the most aggressive firms in the country. And that's why we've been asked to handle cases nationwide, in fact, internationally, right? So you couple that with incredible energy and a group of about 40 lawyers who are singularly focused on representing individuals, and you add to that mix virtually unlimited resources to spend whatever it takes to be successful. It doesn't matter. If we agree to take your case, and there are cases we don't agree to take, we agree to take your case, we're going to spend the time, we're going to do whatever needs to be done, we're going to spend whatever dollar amount it will take to be successful. And our clients very quickly know that, the rest of the legal community knows that, the medical industry knows that, the insurance industry knows that. And so I had a lawyer today. I said, you know what? I just can't take this case. It doesn't meet my threshold. You know, there may be some negligence. Why don't you? He said, Steve, can I put your name on the letter? Can I just put your name on the letter when I write to the hospital? I said, John, go ahead and do it.
Well, it's so interesting you say that, because let's talk about, a lot of times the cases that come into this office come from other lawyers.
The vast majority of our cases. I mean, obviously, Mary has lawyers she's been doing business with for years. Same with Jason. Certainly I do. We get direct referrals. But the firm, remember, we're 40 attorneys, right? And every one of those attorneys is an accomplished trial lawyer. And they get referrals. And when they're medical malpractice cases, they come right down to our office on the 51st floor. So we screen thousands of leads a year. And that's why, in addition to the people you see here, we have a very, very talented staff. And we are very efficient about what we do, but we still have time for that personal touch.
And your network itself. So when something doesn't meet your threshold, you have a network of firms that you work with, and it's a vice versa thing. So that's got to be important. And when you do send a case to somebody, even if it doesn't meet your threshold, it's still important that it's a great attorney that you're sending to, because it's still your initial client.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I would urge your listeners, if they have any kind of legal problem that falls within the personal injury realm, even if not, right, we have a network of attorneys who send us cases, and we know their work product. We know the kind of job that they do. So we're happy to give direction. Anybody can call me at any time. Jason and Mary will tell you, I'm on the phone all day and all night, but I love it. I love it. And I think because we are accessible, we can connect people with the right professionals to help them regardless of what their problem is.
It's such a benefit to the client. And I'm assuming that when a case comes from another attorney, not me, some guy calling up and going, you know, I was on a radio show. No, but it's been vetted. And it's still, I'm sure this firm, well, but I'm sure this firm, you know, that takes it to another level. But I'm saying, I my buddy, I told you, called me the other day. I think I got to admit, I'm like, listen, I'm an idiot, but let's be real. You're doing great. I don't think there's any damages. I do know that much. But it's just a great thing. Not by the way, as we know, not just in the medical malpractice area, but you have those, what are the duck boats and all those
building collapses. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. That says so much about the firm and the culture at the firm and the success level at the firm and the resources. Having said that, let's talk about some of the cases, the types of cases that comprise. It can go, not the exact cases, because I do want to get on a couple name cases, but just a couple minutes, because believe it or not, we got about 15, 20 minutes left, and if I go to break, I'm going to regret it because we're not going to have enough time. Types of medical malpractice cases that you might see the most, and a variety.
I would say that...
She beat you to it there, Jason.
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm just kidding.
he put that bat back.
He was ready to take it back.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, along the same theme of the communication breakdown, I think a majority of the cases that we see, there's some type of a communication breakdown, whether, like you said, the person is in the hospital and they have all these specialists, but they're not communicating with each other, or, you know, somehow a test result doesn't make its way to the physician or doesn't get communicated to the client.
Sure.
But one case that really is memorable to me, and it was a communication breakdown, a very sad case, was a 39-year-old, and he ended up in the hospital requiring, you know, it was an emergent, he wasn't a sick, he was a healthy guy, but he needed emergency surgery. The surgery was a success, and then what happened, it was such a tragedy, so after the surgery, he was ordered a controlled pain pump of Dilaudid, and then there was some communication breakdown. Okay. There was a communication breakdown in the way the order was written, and there was a communication breakdown amongst the people caring for him, and he passed away.
Okay, so you mentioned Dilaudid, right? I took it 4 days. It was, I mean, literally in my entire life, I don't even take medicine. You mentioned that? I can't even imagine it.
Yeah, so it was tragic, but...
And how long did that case take?
So actually, you know, most of the investigation occurred after it was ensued. I mean, we had our experts lined up, but then it was, you know, it required a lot of experts, toxicology, physicians. There was an autopsy, things like that. And after we got the case ensued, and, you know, it didn't take long. It was such a tragedy that happened.
And I wonder sometimes, and Jason, we'll continue that conversation, but how do you keep it together in a sense? I say that,
easy.
Well, it's a good, you know, I mean.
It's really not easy.
When that phone rings, there's a tragedy on there, even if it's not a case. There's a chance, but I'm just saying, there's cases like that and parents calling. How do you be, being a great lawyer is not just knowing the law, we know that, but it's having the ability, obviously, to be able to deal with the situations, represent the clients, and be in control.
I think the answer to that is going to be individual for all three of us. So all I can say is that some of the most common advice I got when I started practicing law was that you need to be able to divorce yourself from your case and leave work in the office and go home and be at home. And I think that, for me, was some of the worst advice that I've ever received. I obsess over my cases. I treat my clients like they're family. I get involved, and it's the only way that I know how to do things. And if I approach cases as though the person who I didn't know before they were injured is a person that I care about, then I do start to care about that person. I'm going to spend 4 years, 3-4 years of your life getting to know you. getting to know everything about you, and I need to approach it that way. And I think that that's the only way that I can personally provide the kind of care that I need to for my patients.
Steve?
And I think that's one of the strengths. I mean, we are open and honest about it. Our emotions do get involved. I have a family. I have kids. You know, when I hear about harm to kids, it affects me. Right? But because we approach these cases with both our minds and our hearts, I think we are in a better position to make a difference. It doesn't impede us in handling these cases. It strengthens our resolve to achieve the kind of result that we're looking for in our cases. So, yeah, we laugh, we cry, we react to these cases like any other human being. Right, but that's the way that you get in touch with your clients. That's the kind of bond that you want. And when you go before a jury, if they see that you are not only intellectually involved but emotionally involved, you have a leg up on the defense attorney. And you know, I don't even try. I wouldn't be a good poker player.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to play poker. Right. I'm trying to, literally, when I'm in front of a jury, and I tell my clients this, you know, you got to let your hair down. I let it all hang out.
Yeah.
You know, they got to understand that I'm passionate about these cases.
How many clients do you still have relationships with, or families of clients that, you know, you represented at, if you for 3-4 years?
Dozens. I mean, there's you know, obviously, over time, relationships fade. We all experience that with family and friends. But, you know, even if it is a snapshot in time, right, I'm very proud of the fact that we make a difference in people's lives. And we feel good about it. You know, when Jason goes home, when Mary goes home, you know, they can feel that satisfaction of knowing that they made a difference. I don't know any other way to approach it. I'm not a machine. I don't want our lawyers to be machines. We are aggressive warriors, but we have hearts.
When you're in a situation, when you're in a situation that somebody calls that phone up and they're emotional and you're doing all that, that's Jason. When somebody's coming into that office and you know it was a catastrophic situation, you have to prepare for that family to walk through that door.
It's not
okay.
Easy.
Yeah. How do you prepare for that? How do you you know, keep it together?
I think, well, to be fair, I've had a really good mentor in that, in Steve. And I think that it's something that when I started practicing, I guess, 13 years ago with him, I was afraid to meet with a family that suffered a tragedy without Steve, because you really don't want to say the wrong thing. And I think that over time, you just have to learn to be yourself. And the truth of the matter is that if someone's coming to give me the opportunity to represent them for a loss that they've suffered, then I appreciate that. And I'm not going to spend any less time or any less thought thinking about their case than any other case. And I just want them to know that I'm interested, that I want to try to help, and that I care. So you just have to be yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that always amazes me with what I'm, you know, just thinking about what you do on a daily basis. Here's a good example. When I was talking about the types of cases that involve children, When you're bringing, you know, neonatal type stuff, okay? Did it take you, Steve? When you've been doing this 40 years, but the first or second or third year coming in, but even now, you know, what's that process like?
I think I can sum it all up like this. I'm sitting there with Mary and or Jason or both of them, and we listen to the story, and we see the damage that's been caused, and maybe we see the baby or the child. And I have the same line every time. We say goodbye to the client, and then I look at them and I go, do you have any problems? Do you have any problems? And the answer is no. And I'll tell you, I have learned so much about how to live my life. I have been so fortunate to meet people who are dealing with all the things that you and I are dealing with on a daily basis, all the BS, all, you know, you name it. And then on top of that, they're dying of cancer. On top of that, they have a child with cerebral palsy. On top of that, you know, they're dealing with a disfiguring medical problem. And I always say the same thing. And I get up every morning, I look in the mirror. What problems do you have? Right. You know, we all wake up. We're upset about something. We're thinking about something, you know. And then it helps us. And I know I speak for Mary and Jason. Put life in perspective. To see people who have been so severely affected and yet go on with their lives because they don't have a choice.
Absolutely.
You have to bring your personal experiences to that, to those meetings. All right, everyone, not just personal injury lawyers, not radio hosts. It doesn't matter who it is, knows someone who's been diagnosed with cancer. Nowadays, everyone knows someone that struggles with addiction.
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's okay when someone is when someone is telling you what they've suffered, to not say that you understand exactly what they're suffering, but to let them into your life, to know that you're human too, and that you can relate. And I think that a lot of times that makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's empathy and just natural empathy and being who you are. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what, it sure says a lot about the firm and the culture at the firm and the people that are here. I mean, we've done several shows. I've had almost everybody on, and there's
thanks
a comment.
Thanks for saving us to last.
What? Always last?
I said, thanks for saving us to last. I said, almost everyone.
Well, hold on.
Best for last.
Right, exactly. Come on, Jason.
Yeah, give him a break.
I've been working really hard here. I don't even think I'm last. In fact, I don't know how many, you know, he's got so many teams. But the point is, before we wrap up, settlements and going to trial, what's the percentage there?
Well, I think most cases ultimately settle. Sometimes we have to pick a jury. Sometimes we put testimony.
Take it to the last to see if they're really.
Sometimes we go to verdict. I mean, there are so many variables involved, but most cases do resolve before trial. But one of the reasons that they resolve and resolve favorably is because they know that we're ready to try the case.
Sure.
If you want to get a case settled, get prepared for trial, right? Because, you know, that's going to put the fear of God in them. And of course, deadlines are very important, too. When you get that trial listing, everybody's feet is to the fire. And you know, at the end of the day, our clients decide. We work for our clients. Now, they always, 99.99% of our clients say, Steve, you're the lawyer.
Right,
what should I do? But I, you know, my practice is to turn it around and get them involved. And if I've been communicative, which I hope I am in every one of my cases, and they understand the good points, the bad points, because every case is a mixed bag, and what the possibilities are, then they're in a position to assist.
But it's interesting, though, because when somebody comes up with an insurance company comes up with an offer, okay, and it sounds to a regular person like me like it's a substantial offer, okay, but you know it's worth more, but there's still risk in going to in the court. How do you handle that? Is that a team conversation? Research? I mean, Steve, I know you've been, you know, your experience and all those things. That's a major responsibility.
I don't do it alone, right? I will talk to Mary. I will talk to Jason. We have at Salts Mongoloozy an incredible system. We, every Tuesday morning, every attorney in the firm is in a meeting together. Right now it's been on Zoom, all right, but we're getting back. I just came from an executive committee meeting in person. And one of the things that we do that is very, very unique is we vet cases. We do PowerPoint presentations. We talk about cases, and then every attorney in the firm will email the presenting attorney with their opinion as to value. So, you know, where are you going to get the opinion of 40 experienced trial lawyers in one place? You just can't do it. So you know, when you add that to the fact that we monitor every verdict in the city of Philadelphia and the surrounding counties, when you add that to the fact that we have been trying and handling these cases for decades, our collective gut is a pretty good indicator of what a jury is going to do. But again, at the end of the day, clients have said to me, Steve, you may be right. You know, I understand you want to take it to verdict. That's what you always say. All right. But this kind of money will make a difference to me. I want you to settle the case. The case is going to settle. The case is going to settle.
What's great about that is that they know they're in a firm that is not, in other words, it's not about the firm and what the firm needs. It's what the client needs. Right. And that, by the way, is you know, it's you can imagine what a victim, somebody whose life has been ravaged, and they're depending on that attorney to make the right decision for them. Having the resources and everything that you have here at Saltz Montgomery, can give them the comfort to know that the decision's going to be made in their best interest, or at least they're going to get that option of making that decision.
Right.
Listen. This has been an awesome show. I have about 100 more questions, but I can tell you this: this show has demonstrated why Saltz Montgomery is caught above everybody else. And I just want to say continued success and keep doing what you do for your clients.
Thank you very much, Joe. We appreciate it.
I want to thank everybody for joining in to the Saltz Montgomery Bendesky Hour. We've had a fantastic show. Of course, we want to thank our guests on the broadcast who do a fantastic job. Steve Wigreiser, who is the chair of the Medical Malpractice Department, of course, Mary Jadaro and Jason Weiss. Fantastic broadcast. On behalf of everybody on the panel, I'm Joe Dockery. Have a great day.